Hello, Bonsai friends. This is Evan Pardue of Underhill Bonsai, and welcome to episode 86 of Little Things for Bonsai People. It is the year 2024, the year of the Wood Dragon, and I am coming in from the headquarters of Little Things, the Little Things headquarters today. It's just going to be me, but I am joined by some really special guests today. I have a good handful of guests, actually. Today, we're going to be talking to Eli Atkins of Waldo Street Pottery. How's it going, Eli?
Great. How are you, Evan?
Pretty good. And then Preston Tolbert. Did I say that last name right?
Tolbert.
Sorry. I'm notorious for saying names wrong, so just bear with it. Preston Tolbert of Tolbert Pottery. How's it going, Preston?
Hey. Doing great.
Awesome. And then also we have Robert Wallace of Wallace of the Woods Pottery. How's it going, Robert, or is it Rob?
Either one works.
Yep. Cool. Awesome. So we got all these gentlemen on today to talk about bonsai pottery. If you guys are not aware, these are all some of the best bonsai potters in North America, in my opinion. So welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, definitely. But before we get into that, before we start nerding out about pottery, we do need to mention that this podcast is sponsored by our amazing Patreons over at patreon.com/littlethingsforbonsaipeople. Head on over there, become a bonsai best bud, and hang out in the Discord with these amazing people. So I'm just going to go ahead and say our featured bonsai best bud this week is Tiffany Arsenal. I'm sorry. Actually, your name is Timothy. I always say it wrong whenever I do the spew of bonsai best buds of the MO. He'd say his name Tiffany. I think I'm just gonna roll for it now and just change his name. But Tim Arsenal, or Timothy Arsenal, is the director and creator of the Bonsai Bar, which is one of our podcast sponsors. So thank you for sponsoring our show, Tim, and also Bonsai Bar. And of course, our main podcast sponsor is Joshua Roth Tools. Thank you, Joshua Roth, John of Joshua Roth. And then we have our specimen best buds, Unrai Yuen and Bill Butler of Bill's Bayou. And I can't go much further without thanking our editor, Matt O'Donnell. He makes us sound smart, cleans up our audio, makes us enjoyable to listen to. Go over to mattodonnell.com to work with Matt on either your own podcast show or an audio engineering project if you're a musician. He's also a musician. He's a set bassist in Nashville, Tennessee. He's an all-around awesome guy. It's in the show notes. I say it every single time. And like I said, I have some... Well, I didn't say this. I said it before we started recording, but I do have some announcements, both including things for the podcast and also for things that are just coming up. So new Little Things for Bonsai People t-shirts are on their way. I went and put them through. They're getting printed now as we speak. And we've got a couple of designs that we had before and also a new design that hasn't been seen before yet that will be coming up in the next couple of weeks, maybe in a month. And then as far as bonsai shows and stuff go, I like to kind of go through the list here of things that are going on. I know that the Epcot International Flower and Garden Show is happening in 2025. I don't know exactly when the date of that is, but Bonsai Societies of Florida is currently taking applications. This is something you guys might know. Does anybody know where the next ABS in 2025 is going to be?
I don't know. 25, is it New Orleans, maybe?
I thought New Orleans was going to be 2026.
And 26 is Asheville.
Yeah. Asheville. Okay.
Maybe New Orleans 27.
Yep. Yeah, I remember New Orleans getting pushed back pretty far for, you know, just because of organizing things. But maybe I'll get the location and the date for ABS 2025. And then the Pacific Bonsai Expo is going to be October 26th to 27th in this year, 2024, in Oakland, California. Go over to pacificbonsaiexpo.org and go see if you can get some tickets. I plan on being at the next one in 2025. I think the date bounces around on that one. Happy to announce that Save Bonsai 2025 is going to be happening over here in Folsom, Louisiana, at Underhill Bonsai. Me, Carmen, and Mike are going to be doing live demonstrations as well as a Little Things for Bonsai People live recording. It's pretty exciting. Guy Guidry is expected to return, and we have a list of guest artists that I'm going to be announcing over the next couple of months. The National Show, the next National Bonsai Exhibition, it's going to be in September 13th to 14th, 2025, Rochester, New York. If you guys haven't been to either the Bonsai Expo or the National Show, I would highly suggest you go to it. And then just because I was over there recently and I actually saw a couple of these guys at both the Bonesai on the Bayou. I saw Eli for sure. And then up in Bonesai Central, I saw Rob and Preston and Eli all at the same time. But Bonesai on the Bay in Texas is going to be September 18th, 21st, 2025. That's going to be Jennifer Price, Jonas Dupuy, and Mike Lane as special guests. So, yeah, a lot of really cool stuff coming up. So if y'all are in those areas or willing to travel to Bonesai shows, these are some of the, in my opinion, some of the bigger shows that you can attend. Of course, there's also going to be the Bonesai Society's Florida show convention. That's coming up next year in May. But I feel like I've talked way too much about Bonesai shows. So starting off the list of our guests today. So we got Eli, Preston, and Rob. I don't know who wants to go first and kind of introduce themselves, tell us a little bit about yourselves. I feel like it's kind of like a round table kind of thing, but whoever wants to go first, tell the listeners who you are.
My name's Eli Akins. I'm from Waldo Street Pottery in Atlanta, Georgia, making Bonesai pods since 2013. And I like to show up to the local and national shows.
Yeah. Cool.
I'm Preston Talbert. I've been making pots for about 20 years or so. And actually, Rob got me into making Bonesai pots about 2007, something like that. And I'm starting a pottery center here in North Carolina.
Awesome.
I'm Rob Wallace. I started getting into Bonesai pots around 2003. And actually met Preston when I was doing my graduate work. That's where we kind of got to work together, both in wood firing and then kind of exchanging interest in functional pottery as well as Bonesai pottery. But I started making Bonesai pots in 2003.
And then, so all the dates are, I was trying to put all the dates in my mind and kind of get the amount of experience that we have right here. But we have a good bit of Bonesai pottery experience on this episode today. And also, you guys are all North Carolina guys.
Well, correct? Southeast, Georgia and North Carolina.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I'm sorry, I missed that one. So, but it's all, I guess you can say, Southeast Bonesai pottery, United States kind of thing. But that's really awesome, guys. And I've seen a pot in display in most of the shows that I've seen. I've seen at least one of you guys' pieces, either in Bonesai shows or at Bonesai museums and stuff like that. I'm not very familiar with Preston's work. I haven't really seen any of your stuff. I'm sorry if I don't recognize your signature. I haven't seen your stuff. But I mean, I don't know. It doesn't mean anything.
Prepare yourself.
Yeah.
Okay, so just agree for it when you see it, because it's amazing.
Awesome. Yeah. And I am trying to do my best to carry a piece from each one of the potters here. So I know I already have some of Eli's stuff and some of Robert's stuff. I'm obviously going to have to get some Preston stuff here really soon. But yeah, I mean, I've always believed I wouldn't say that you guys are locals, but you're local enough to North American potters that I consider you guys like our neighbors. So
definitely.
Yeah. So you guys, from my understanding, are all good friends. Y'all do collaborative works together. So tell me a little bit about that.
We met at the first Bonesai Winter Silhouette show in Annapolis in 2010. Is that right? Or no, 2012, something like that.
We're on the truck on this year. So.
Yeah, that would be about right.
Yeah,
something like 2012. And we got to know each other kind of well. Rob and I already knew each other for years. And, it's kind of a thing where we just call each other every couple of weeks and send a lot of texts, and we meet together and make pots.
Mm-hmm. So
it's one of those things too. There's a lot of different experiences that we each have, and it's been a lot of fun to be able to work at our own studios and then kind of get together and work in each other's studios and, exchange techniques and ideas, because there aren't that many people that make Bonesai pots. And, being able to work with somebody who's made some really high quality ones and just kind of that exchange of techniques and ideas has been a lot of fun. absolutely been very beneficial. That first year that they worked as vendors at that Bonsai Winter Silhouette Show, I was there as a spectator, met these guys, was completely enamored with their work, and I'd been making pots. I just started kind of that year, or was about to get started. I can't exactly remember which, but that really felt like I connected with these guys through that.
Yeah. And so who's got the setup that everybody prefers to kind of go hang out and see? I don't know where you guys are located. Is there a certain area that you guys like to go and connect with nature, or is there some equipment that you guys favor? Like, how's it all? I'm so lost in the weeds when it comes to bonsai pottery and collaborations like this.
We all have our own studios with different types of kilns and everything. And it's fun to just go to a different place. Like the last time we met up was down at Eli's place in Atlanta, and getting down there and being able to work with him was just a great experience. So we all have kind of our own thing. So regardless of where we go, it's going to be a little bit different. That's part of the fun.
And we try to, do different things too. Like this one, we specifically made a point of spent the day glazing yesterday. We loaded up, a cone 6 reduction gas kiln and a cone 10 kind of residual soda kiln. And so just thinking about, how we can try something we hadn't done before. Since Preston has these kilns as an option, it was just an opportunity to make that one of the things we're doing at this get together.
Right. Yeah.
And when we go to one another's place, it's interesting because you kind of have to adapt to where you are, which I think is very beneficial in learning.
Yeah. And so I haven't seen enough of y'all's pieces to see the greater connections, but from my understanding, all of you guys have influenced each other over the last couple of years or year or so from doing this together. So, I mean, what shared common traits would you guys say? Like, is there something that, like maybe Eli made a pot that looked like Robert's, or Preston did something that, what is there something you guys are starting to kind of map together here?
Size is very common between us. We all work on large pieces, so.
Okay.
I guess where we kept the big way.
I don't think there's a huge connection between our work as far as the form of the pots as much as maybe because Rob gas fires with soda some and I do some gas firing with soda. That's fairly unique in the bonsai world.
Yeah.
That's about the only thread I can think of that's that similar.
I don't know. I would also argue that I think we have a similar philosophy. I think when we approach the clay, I think, we were discussing this morning as we were throwing pots, like the joy of being able to sit down in a wheel and kind of let the pot make itself, kind of figuring out. And then like, you make a little mark or a little ding in the pot that you didn't plan and you kind of work that in and you feel like that's part of the spontaneity or the, that impression of the moment. And I think that different pots we each make have different levels of like maybe sharpness, cleanliness, refinement. I think we all appreciate the organic spontaneity and want to maintain that in a strong presence at our work.
And on a more superficial note, I've definitely stolen a style of foot that Rob uses. So here you go.
Yeah. So different styles of, like you said, a style of foot in particular. And is it just because you've seen it, like you think it works better for certain designs, or is it just because you're trying to, pay homage to your friend?
Rob came up with this little pitch thing in his Cascade pots. And I was like, that is just such a genius type of drainage hole that also acts as a really nice way to put a wire tie in. It's like, I couldn't help but take it,
Yeah. I think I saw one of those style holes on a crescent. Was it the crescent pot that you sent me, Rob?
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. That's a really cool concept.
Yeah. And, it was up without a huge volume of drainage necessary. It's a hidden, but yet functions and drains. So, and I think there's a lot of those little things that, one of the things I've just really enjoyed about this collaborative project is, being able to the nuances that you don't really think about that you need, but realize that somebody is doing that would really benefit your work. know, and sometimes it's something that's not visible to finish pot, but it's a step that makes the finish pot simpler or easier. You know, and I think that's been even as much as how do you roll out a giant slab, you know, and it, each of us kind of like going through like, what do we do? And, you know, Preston pulls out the giant Thor hammer and, you know, beats the clay in remission. And, you know, I've got like my little cheese slice, jumbo sized cheese slicer and tossing technique. And, you know, Eli's got his processes and, you know, just it's fun to kind of see that because I think that sometimes I just marinate for a while. And then they kind of just pop up when the time's right.
Right. Right. And I think sometimes it's seeing the way another person does things. It can be the smallest thing and the most elementary thing that changes your game. I think that's a wonderful reason to get together with other putters and just influence and learn from each other all the time.
It's easy to sit in your own studio and just keep cranking away, doing your own thing and not looking anywhere else. Mm-hmm. But you really grow when you cross-contaminate with other
forced exposure elsewhere.
Yeah, I get that same vibe. Like if I'm working with another bonsai practitioner, it always helps to kind of, even if they're not doing anything, to work in with your own piece or your own tree, with you guys in y'all's case, y'all's own pottery that you're creating. It always had like that camaraderie of having some, like another creative there. Kind of, it builds a special kind of energy kind of feel. Now, I know what you guys are talking about because, like I said, having other people working on bonsai alongside me, but definitely working on a tree with somebody else, like you said, the smallest little thing that they do, it seems like, you're like, oh, well, now that I see it that way, and they might not even realize that they had done something, like tweaked something the tiniest bit, and you're like, you have an aha moment. So the energy of having multiple creatives in a single room really does go a long ways, like you guys said. And so, yeah, I mean, I totally vibe with what you guys got going on. And I mean, I'm a little envious that you guys get to do this often because it is a struggle currently right now to get even like, for instance, if I wanted to get Carmen or Mike to come in, hang out and do bonsai. I mean, these people are on the other sides of the map where you guys are a little bit closer than I would say me and Mike and Carmen are. But yeah, it is a beautiful thing to be able to get together and do these types of projects, I'm sure. And so you guys also have, is it coming up or has it already happened, the Bonsai Mirai kind of getaway type thing y'all are doing?
That's all in the works right now. And, okay. You know, we'll have a little bit more information as we develop it.
Yeah. I remember talking to one of you guys about that and said that was something special coming up. But yeah, I guess for our listeners, just kind of keep your ears peeled. I know that's something you guys have worked with Ryan with. But if there's little to no information, then we can't really discuss it. But, you know.
Yeah. So it's in the future, but it's going to happen. We're just ironing out details now.
Yeah. Any kind of teasers of what that might entail? Or you guys want to kind of keep it a secret?
I'm just kind of, it's not a secret. It's just kind of what we're doing here now is sort of getting together when we can. And we hope to do it another time or two this year before going out there just to get our bearings straight with one another and continue to develop our work relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. Sounds like
part of it too is like, you know, letting the experience be the influence as well.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, as I mentioned, going into each other's studios and being able to say, oh, you know, I'm going to try this new tool that you have and see how that it works with me. I think, you know, the idea of going out west, you know, and seeing different parts of the country and, you know, working hopefully, you know, around, you know, Ryan's collection, it just, we'll have to kind of let it happen as it happens and see how it permeates into, you know, design and aesthetics. But, you know, I'm excited about, you know, the prospect. You know, and right now, you know, we're just having a great weekend, you know, in Stiefel, North Carolina, and, you know, going to be unloading, finishing one kiln probably in about, I don't know, 4 or 5 hours. And then tomorrow morning, finishing another. And then we get the fun experience of the unloading, you know, and like seeing each other's pots and watching how glazing was done and then being able to see the results as a, you know, byproduct. So,
yeah.
One aspect of what we do is make collaborative pots. So we're not just making our own pots with each other. We're starting something and passing it on to the next person so that they can do their thing. And I think it's an interesting thing to compare to bonsai, because with bonsai, you have to work really hard at a tree and your fingerprints don't really show up. And then it changes eventually in the future. Whereas with pots, every tiny thing you do shows up,
right?
And then you put it in a kiln and it's done. It's not going to change after that for the most part. There may be some patina, sure, but that's it for 40,000 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. For as long as it, you know, it doesn't go into the core of the earth and melt down.
Right.
Because ceramics is forever, like you said. Once, I can't remember which potter told me, but I heard something like, I think it was maybe my college professor that was in ceramics told me that every piece of pottery created, it's basically like creating another rock, like how rocks are created over millions of years, but then they could, that rock could last forever. I mean, we're melting it down into basically, I mean, it is more akin to what glass is, because you can break it, but the particles that you guys are creating from the firing process does have the ability to last almost forever.
Yeah. As it was told to me, the pieces enter into the geological record of the earth.
Because of the chemical reaction. Yeah. So I was going to ask you guys, how many pieces do you feel like y'all have created this weekend so far?
We basically just got started this morning, so like five, maybe.
We have five started. We spent the whole day yesterday glazing and packing kilns, and on a very hot day. And today we took it easy, resting in a little bit, and then got to work.
Cool.
So, but we still have the rest of tonight, tomorrow, and Wednesday. So the goal is, you know, we're going to make certainly some collaborative pots that, you know, we each kind of have a hand on. We're each going to work on our own individual kind of bodies of work, but, you know, open to the idea of, you know, hey, what do you think about this? Can you show me this or that? And you know, letting it be not just producing the work we always produce, but being able to use it as an opportunity to explore as well, you know, kind of like a little time out from just being in your own studio, doing your own thing.
One of our methods of collaboration is for one of us to, or actually all three of us to make some shapes and then pass it to the next person. They put feet on, they make, alter the shape a little bit, put some marks on the surface, and then it gets fired and goes to the next person who glazes and does the surface treatment.
Yeah.
So we're kind of trying out different things on different people's
forms, like, and stuff,
working out our ideas with their ideas.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. For our listeners, we've had a couple of, if this is your first episode being introduced to ceramicists and the way that pottery works, I know we've had Byron Myrick on in the past. We had Tori Solis on. And then we had another potter, maybe. Not sure. We've had quite a few potters on the show. It's been a while. Just excuse me for that. But yeah, the process of creating pottery, these guys are either throwing or hand building. It depends on how you guys feel, I'm guessing. And then that piece is allowed to become leather hard, or it can still be workable to some extent. And they will pass it off to another one of the artists, their circle of friends here. And then they will, you know, like you said, apply something to it, either a different type of foot. Have you guys been experimenting with like sculptural aspects, like reliefs or other things like that on y'all's pottery?
We definitely attack the surface, if that's what you're asking.
Yeah.
Well, and I would say one of our collaborations at Eli's, I think Preston had a pot he brought back and had it kind of stored for several months, and then it was fairly firm, and so he just, you know, did his next component carving everything out of in reduction, you know, so it was all sculptural, kind of creating from a thick oval into something that had very sharp, clean edges, because it was firm enough that it could be almost, you know, kind of knifed out into its final shape, you know. So it's reductive processes, additive processes, you know, the firing processes, you know, whether it goes into a reduction kiln, electric kiln, a gas kiln, a soda kiln, you know, all those are, within the scope of the clay body. You know, you've talked with other potters, you understand that you have to match the clay body that you're using to the firing temperatures. You know, so there's that limitation, but we try to plan it to where the person that takes it home is using a clay body that they can clearly have firing options in their home kilns.
Isn't so. Yeah. And yeah, kind of elaborate more on that is with different clay bodies, like you said, become with different restrictions or different ways you have to approach to firing it. I'm trying to make it a little digestible for our listeners if this is their first time listening to Ceramicist Talk Shop. I guess you can say this is really what it is. It's talking shop with three great ceramicists who, you know, you guys clearly understand y'all's medium like that. There's a lot of different ways to approach it, like you said, as far as, you know, carving or surface treatments and stuff like that, which was a really interesting part, because with ceramics, there's unlimited options to what you can do. You don't just have to press your finger into the surface of the clay and cause a dent or, you know, pass a carving knife over it to do some kind of whittling on the clay body or whatever you might do. You might also can make additions to the clay as well. Like, I knew some potters that will build forms and then attach them to their pots. And I know that's a little tricky sometimes, because application on that can be the bonding of the clay, especially when you're working with separate pieces. I'm sure feet pop off of there, or some extra appendage that the pot has provided might pop off in a kiln firing. But that adds to the challenge and the uniqueness to these pieces. So that's kind of one of the ways I look at ceramics too, you know.
And I would say one more thing that I think has been really kind of fun on top of that is that, you know, we have individual works that we make, and this happens as a bonsai potter, but then also collaborative, is sometimes seeing the next step, which is seeing the creative bonsai artist, you know, use these pieces in compositions and designs, you know. And we've had some kind of heavy loud, I would say, kind of pots we've made that were a lot of fun. And then just watching, like, you know, the artist and the way they try to work with something that's a little out of the box, that kind of almost is another collaborative step that we don't have control over, but it can be, you know, a connection that I think is a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we're talking more along the lines of less traditional Japanese forms when it comes to pottery, correct?
Yeah, I would say that none of us are on the really kind of traditional side. I think that we all have different levels of, you know, homage to what you would get from an imported classic Chinese or Japanese pot. But I would say, you know, I know at least for my work, I have a influence by it, but it's definitely just one of a variety of influences. Even, you know, traditional, you know, American potters that didn't do bonsai pots. And I think all three of us have, you know, I think probably a very wide spectrum of influence, mm-hmm. outside of just the traditional kind of forms and colors and, you know, shapes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things I really like to do is to make a pot that I don't think will be a good pot and see if anybody wants to use it. You know what I'm saying? I just make something. You know, the challenge is my own ideas of what bonsai should be. And, you know, sometimes somebody comes along and uses it and it works. So,
creating art for other artists and hoping that it resonates with the work that they're trying to accomplish as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was poking around on Etsy one time and I saw this one pot that was very unique and very particular. It was a baby shoe. So, in the description of the pot that the guy was selling, he was actually a UK artist. He put on there, he said, my other potter friends challenged me to make a shoe and then plant something in it and then see if I can make a pot that would not only look just like a baby shoe, but it also could support a planting in it. And so that kind of stuff really intrigued me. I actually bought that container because I thought it was so intriguing, because I really love stories when there's a story behind a piece like that. Just like the piece that whenever I was at Bonsai Central, I was getting ready to purchase that pot from Eli that had the flag painted on it, the Jamaican flag, if I'm if I remember right.
Right, with the colors of the Jamaican flag, yes.
Yeah, and that was a really cool pot. And you don't see a lot of stuff like that. And like you said, like make something weird where you're like, is someone going to figure out how to use this? And that's,
right.
that's, go ahead.
I was just going to say that definitely was a pot with a story. The design of that did come from a story. And it also is one of those ones that occurs late at night when I'm in the studio and the creative bug really comes out and I want to do something different.
Yeah. That happens a lot whenever close to the point of working ourselves to the bone almost, where we're like, okay, I produced X amount of pots. I had a quota today, or for me, I've worked on enough trees. And then all of a sudden you have this piece sitting around that you're like, you know what? Screw it. You know, I'm exhausted. I'm half, sleep deprived at this point. But like you said, the creative juices seem to function at that point of an artist's madness almost. That's what kind of how I see it. And some really fun stuff, some really unpredictable things could happen at that moment. Not going to say they're all successes, but yeah, you do see stuff where you're like, you wake up the next morning, you're like, what happened? You know, it's like jazz music, you know, it just kind of happened. It's improvised. So
my, the potter that I was apprenticed to called it end of the day pots is the end of the day. You're kind of wore out. You got a bunch of scraps on the table. What are you going to make with it?
Yeah. Do you cut one in half and then join it to another one? Or do you squish it a little bit and, you know, put some weird, you know, feed on it or something? Like, there's just so many possibilities, you know. And I'm sure, and I've seen a couple of pieces of, you know, professional bonsai pottery where I look at this, you know, I look at a slab or a piece that just is shaped kind of weird. And then they, you know, they stuck feet on there. And sometimes it makes me think, like you said, like there's just some pieces sitting around that deserve a second chance, like a second life kind of feel to it. I think that stuff's really intriguing to me, you know.
This podcast is supported by Bonsai Bar, the beginner bonsai workshop popping up in breweries all across the Northeast. Bonsai Bar is 2 hours of tiny tree goodness disguised as a night out with friends. Come grab drinks, create a new tree, and watch as your friends and family get the bug for bonsai. Bonsai Bar is always looking for teachers and assistants, and you listen to this podcast, so you're probably already qualified. Bring your knowledge out to the bar. Apply today. Find event tickets, contact info, and more at bonsaibar.com.
That's why I was kind of asking about the Japanese traditional versus American style. And since I've got 3 pretty adept American bonsai potters, I mean, do you guys feel like American bonsai pottery has found its place? Is it a style now?
I think the Western aesthetic is definitely a style, not limiting it only to America, but Europeans as well. I think that having the legacies of Ron Lang and Sarah Rayner now with us, I think that it is definitely established.
Yeah.
There's other potters in that mix too, but those two come to mind immediately.
I've heard Ron Lang and Sarah Rayner, which is Sarah Rayner still producing pottery?
He is.
Okay. I had heard something that she was taking some time off, but I guess not.
She did post that she's not going to do more shows this year, but she does post to her website every now and again.
Yeah. I mean, there's different reasons why different bonsai potters will take some time off, or, you know, personal reasons or just creative reasons. I mean, you can't get to a point where I guess you guys could feel like y'all made the same thing over and over again. And then, of course, doing something like you're doing right now, meeting up and producing material collaboratively, this is also going to help kind of cure that creative block, I guess, if any of you guys are experiencing that. So yeah, go ahead.
I was just agreeing.
Well, there was a period when Rob started making functional tableware and wasn't making bonsai pots for a while. And I started making more bonsai pots at that time. And then I laid off bonsai pots for a little while and Rob cranked back up and started making them again. So it's kind of this ebb and flow.
Mm-hmm. And I've held fast because I got into making pots just to make bonsai pots. And now I make some functional stuff too, but I'm in it for the bonsai work. So I've kind of stayed the course. I kind of wanted to, just thinking out loud, but you know, you mentioned about the aesthetic of American, you know, bonsai pottery. And
I would initially kind of, I would say I would agree with Eli in the sense that not limiting it to just American, but I think European is a similar, more freeing, more open approach. And, mm-hmm. and I wonder if it's also a fact that more American and European potters don't delve into just one thing, you know, like they may have other styles of ceramics that they work in, and maybe that, you know, makes it more free. And again, I don't know the answer to that. I'm just throwing this out there. Whereas maybe in the traditional kind of Japanese model and Chinese is they were kind of working in a very production-based setting where that was the kind of thing they did their whole career, you know, as opposed to having some time making platters, having some time making, you know, some mugs or developing an aesthetic outside of just bonsai pots, allowing that to influence, you know, your desire to make bonsai pots, but maybe with additional elements that maybe wouldn't feel as traditional. And I don't know, just a thought.
Yeah, I do feel like working in other forms and other functional wares definitely influenced my bonsai pots and betters me as a maker.
So yeah, I was down in New Orleans this past weekend. The time of this recording, it's irrelevant, but this was like 2 weeks ago then. Alex and Cindy Williams of Pots A Lot in New Orleans. I was down there talking to them and about mostly with Alex because he was available to talk about functional pottery and his experiences in pottery. And funny enough, I had this weird, really weird connection that I found with him and Brussels Bonsai. So Brussels had moved their location from their original location to their newer, larger acreage location they currently operate on now. And Alex and Cindy Williams actually operated a pottery studio on the original locations because Brussels Martin offered it to them, which just blew my mind. I just walked into this ceramic shop that I really respect. I really like their work a lot. Some really like, I guess you can say a little bit more of the American style of functional pottery that you will see a lot more of that really refined, either, you know, very, very sophisticated glazing techniques or very, you know, just refine these interesting forms that, you know, take something like a cup or a mug or a pitcher or a vase and just make it have this elevated kind of just high art kind of feel to it. And I just thought it was really funny how like they were like, oh yeah, Brussels Martin talked to us about that. But the reason why I brought them up is because I was thinking about functional pottery and I love functional pottery as far as, you know, all of my coffee cups in my house that I use, I always use a artisan, like a potter's made cup. We have a bunch of things that we use in our house, like down to like our olive oil dispenser is made by a potter as well. So I thought this was really cool that we get to talk about a little bit about functional stuff. And you said that going into functional kind of alleviates that grind of making bonsai pottery. And I find that to be very interesting because that's the basis.
Total opposite for me. Total opposite for me.
Oh, yeah. So
many they're making mugs. I mean, and I started this to make bonsai pots and I started in a community studio. I was the only person making bonsai pots. I think it's just developed up very quickly.
Yeah, I make utilitarian pottery as my main pottery, and I make bonsai pots for fun.
So, to each their own, kind of dabbling in the functional side. So Preston, you said you make a lot of functional stuff, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, and then occasionally you'll get into a spurt of bonsai pottery, and then when you hang out with these guys, then it's just all bonsai pottery. and then Eli, you prefer bonsai pots, right?
I do, but I also consider those functional works too because they do serve a specific function.
Yeah, and then for you, Rob, functional or bonsai pottery, how do you feel?
So it's kind of been swings at different times, but I'd say in the last, like, 5 years, it's gone almost exclusively bonsai pots. I've kind of hit a second wind in my interest in both bonsai and bonsai pottery. I started in bonsai in 1999, and just like everybody else, you know, kind of have this immediate urge to have one of everything. And I spent a decade, you know, all the bonsai focus, bonsai day, just, you know, and then around, I don't know, 2010, 2012, I started kind of wanting something different, a broader audience, and just to experiment a new way. And so I kind of spent a lot of time making functional stuff, most of 2010 to about 2020, with some bonsai pots mixed in. But, I kind of had that in my exploration. And about 2020, it's come back full swing to where, I've kind of done the functional stuff. I enjoy it, but I'm kind of getting a renaissance in bonsai pottery again.
Yeah. I'm also a kiln builder. And in 2020, Rob hired me to build him a soda kiln for his functional work, and we designed this kiln specifically for his functional tableware and cups and mugs and everything. And then he immediately switched to making bonsai pots. Now the kiln design isn't necessarily ideal for bonsai pots, but he'll make some really nice pots.
And the specifications for functional stuff, I'm assuming those kilns will be taller, more shelf space, whereas bonsai pottery, what do you guys would say? This is a good question. What warrants a good bonsai pottery kiln versus a functional pottery?
One of the things is bonsai pots need to be fired very evenly. Don't want a bonsai pot to have a difference in temperature from one side to the other. And the kiln that I designed for Rob has a fair bit of temperature difference. It's designed to have dramatic effects on the wear. So it's great for making dramatic pots, but for bonsai pots, you tend to lose a few.
And to add to that, so the technical side would be the way the flame travels. That's what's called a cross draft kiln. We have a firebox that has, I have both a wood burning and gas burning firebox, so I can kind of fire with both, which I love that aspect of the kiln. But the flame travels horizontal across the kiln and exits on a chimney on the far end. And so because of that, closer to the firebox, it's hotter, farther away is cooler. A lot of gas kilns that we'd want to use for bonsai would be the downdraft. And that those have a flame pattern that travels to the kind of top of the kiln as an arch and then to the bottom of the kiln to exit. So it kind of evenly flows through the whole kiln. I didn't design that for my soda kiln because I really wanted to have dramatic, one-sided, different faces. And I'll say I still love the aspect of, I want all of my pots to have multiple faces, where you could kind of an oval, you could pick the side. But with the functional ware I was doing at the time, that cross-draft design, like an Onagama kiln would be, you're going to have much more drama side to side as opposed to the downdraft. Now, the electric kiln, which is the kind of the gold standard, I have three of those as well. But those be very good even heat as well because they're radiant heat in for coils. And so, those were great bonsai pots. That's kind of where I'm doing the majority of my bonsai pots now with, three or three times a year, I'll have them dramatic pots. But I'm kind of making those a little smaller to alleviate some of the challenges of uneven temperature.
That's a lot. Yeah, that's in the weeds. But no, it's totally fine though, because I've had this type of talk with I talked with Byron Myrick a good bit about how he approaches all of his different firing techniques, and I had Rob Sheldon. I don't know if you guys have seen any of his work. I know that he was at Bonsai on the Bayou. Eli, you probably had the opportunity to either talk with him or see his work. But he's doing a lot of salt and soda firing stuff as well. Some structural sculptural work that's very particular. And so, when we're talking about uneven firing temperatures and the way that you, like you said, from what I've heard, it's more exciting this way to fire with that type of environment where it's like, what's going to come out of the kiln? But like you said, you lose some because things might not, petrify? Is that the word for it?
Close enough.
Yeah, I know. It's a weird word that I've only learned recently, but you might not get pots that are truly ready to be used for bonsai containers. They might just be more pretty, showpieces, almost kind of like akin to what a wood fire pit would provide you instead. You're not going to really want to use that kind of stuff. So it does have a lot of a give and take from my understanding.
Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah. So
there, You definitely have to do a lot of quality control when you're firing an atmospheric kiln for bonsai pots.
Yeah. So, go ahead.
I said that's why they're more expensive, because you make five pots and two of them work out. You have to put the rest on a pile.
Yep. Okay. Yeah. So for our listeners out there, if you're ever looking at wood fired pieces and you see, you know, a certain percentage markup on everything like that, like that's good evidence there that, you know, it comes straight from all the potter's mouth there, is that like you make all these pieces with high hopes with this type of atmospheric kiln firing. And then, yeah, there's a lot of, I wouldn't call them failures, because do you guys see that as a failure, or how do you guys feel about that type of stuff?
Some failures.
Yeah.
I would refer to it more as a heartache than a failure, because you did go through the proper process to get it there. So it's a learning experience and a heartache, I think, more than a failure for me. I try to look at it that way anyway.
And it also is how half of my trees have homes, because when the pot doesn't come out so perfect or right or flawed, it often lives for, you know, a decade with my trees, you know, because it may not be a pot I'd sell, but it's a pot I'd use.
It's an easier way to sell that pot, is have a tree in.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, from my understanding, those are also called seconds. I've actually purchased a few seconds. And believe it or not, I actually like to collect those. I don't know if you guys have other people that y'all have met. I'm sure y'all have shared stuff like that between other potters, but you think there's an interest in that kind of stuff?
I don't sell any seconds. I have that I really don't like, it gets broken.
Yeah, okay. I have a light circle of people who are helpful and beneficial to me that receive my seconds if they like them and want them.
Yeah.
Well, how I look at it is, there's seconds that are aesthetic flaws that I don't want out there. And there's seconds that have, like, you know, a hairline crack or something that I think is probably going to last forever, but I don't want to sell it for a premium price, knowing that it has a potential to have a fall or, you know, have a problem down the road. And so, you know, usually I keep my seconds that are not aesthetic problems. And as people come to my studio, that's oftentimes where they kind of get the benefit of seeing, you know, some options that they can get good deals on. Knowing that, you know, I point out the flaws or the you know, even as much as like something that might warp a little bit, where depending on your view as a bonsai practitioner, you may find that to be, you know, highly, you know, problematic, or you might find that to be part of the handmade feel, you know, but sometimes those seconds are not seconds in their eye. It's
right. Oftentimes you can find a way to create a feature from a flaw, especially if your tree is going to accentuate what you might consider a flaw as well as might consider a feature.
Yeah, that's what makes it more interesting too, is like we were saying earlier, make something where you're like, who the hell would even want to use this? But then the seconds also can serve their own purpose in that way as well. Whereas you don't expect it on the other end as well, that somebody would want that piece. You know, I've seen... for instance, Byron brought me a piece one time when I was at a show, and he said, if you would like to have this, it's an oval, one side of it sagged down on the end. And he saw it as a second, whereas I, you know, for like you guys said, like it's bonsai practitioner might see that as like, oh, that's actually kind of cool. It does something that you don't expect. But I think, like you said, like Rob said, some of the hairline fracture stuff, that does become a concern. I actually have some pieces sitting in my own bonsai shop that something will have like the smallest crack, but then having experience with different, you know, different pots that I've used or just knowing the thickness and the quality of the clay body, I've looked at some hairline cracks and been like, oh, it's not that big of a deal, especially if it's on the inside of the container. And I've had people still turn it down and say, no, I'm not going to buy that, you know? And apparently there's not enough epoxy in this world either to fix these things as well. But I mean, they do and can still work, you know, like could be a really cool piece. If something happens, then, you know, I've got, like I mentioned way earlier, I've got pieces that something might have popped off because somebody did some kind of sculptural work on there and just glued it back on there, you know. But it does kind of take away from the, I get what you guys are saying, like the feel of creating a piece and it being something that you really want it to represent your work. Because that's what this really comes down to, as well as that representation of each potter and, you know, your work ethics and what you want to create. You want to represent yourself as in the bonsai world and as, you know, ceramics as a medium too. So, you know, I do think that the use of seconds from bonsai potters is interesting. Either a glaze goes wrong or something weird happens with that. But I mean, then does that kind of brings us to a point? Is there bad pottery out there? You know, if someone finds a use for it.
Yes, there is definitely bad pottery out there.
I mean, even a coffee cup that weighs 20 pounds, you know, but.
There can be a purpose for having a super heavy coffee mug. Maybe that person that was making it is wanting to be intentional about, or wants the user to be intentional about how they use it. You know,
yeah.
If it means something, then maybe it's important. But no, there's definitely bad pots out there.
We've lost. Don't be fooled by I think
there's something interesting about the Western aesthetic at bonsai pots. It's the thing that a lot of Western bonsai potters and a lot of Western bonsai pottery collectors shun mold-made pots made in a mold, as if mold-made pots are easier than hand-built pots or build thrown or something else like that. But pots made in mold are probably more difficult than hand-built pots. Like, to make a bonsai pot in a mold properly is very difficult.
Yep. Big up now, Toka. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Like you mentioned, Eli, like now Tokutake is making essentially all of his pots in molds. And he's doing an excellent job. And you look at those pieces, and like you said, like, oh, this is made in a mold. And a lot of people will think, oh, well, like you said, that's easy. You just pour the slip in there and then you pull it out and then it's done. You know, that's not ever the case, especially with higher end pieces that you have to, like I was talking to him now, and he's got a storage unit basically in his backyard with all of his molds that he's created. And he has to make all those by hand with hand cut pieces of wood, and he has to build them and frame them. And like I said, it's a different appreciation for the process. And I think another thing too is, like, with Western and then also the with the, you know, the European culture pottery, things seem to be a little bit more free-formed. So as the trends have evolved, a little bit more of a loose aesthetic to the pottery has become a lot more acceptable. I've definitely seen this in like British potters. I think, is it Aaron Pottery? Is the studio? I don't know who the potter is. So you guys familiar with that one?
Aaron, yeah.
I
know the name, but it's online right now.
Yeah. I remember seeing some of his pots or their pots. I'm not sure if it's a studio or if it's an individual artist, but seeing a lot looser forms and almost near primitive in shapes, and then applying modern glazing. And that kind of feels like, you know, that's just one of the several potters that were doing this coming into, you know, the early 2000s, 2010s, and up till now, where I feel like, that's why I asked you guys earlier, do you think that the American style has taken off? And I would say it is an anonymous agreement that it is established now. So now we just got to see what the American bonsai potter, what that goes from to the American bonsai artist. Like you said, like, we have some really solid American bonsai artists starting to do some really nice things. So, I mean, I can't ask you guys what y'all's hopes and dreams would be for y'all's pieces. I can't, like, take one of y'all and say, well, if you made a pot, what tree would you like to see in this pot? I guess the answer would be anything, really, at this point. Like, what do you guys, I guess the better way to ask the question is, what is the future for American bonsai pottery, in y'all's opinion?
I think it's a logical progression for me. I guess I keep throwing up, I keep making pots that I like, and it's going to progress to the way nature intends it.
Yeah. How about Preston, Rob, what do y'all think?
I would say it's going to go with the direction of the bonsai practitioners, you know, and I think that that is an expanding field right now. I think that it's a growing. I think that as it grows, you're going to have some that their natural aesthetic inclinations are going to be more towards traditional Japanese. And then there's going to be another audience that's naturally drawn more towards, you know, a little bit looser. And I don't want to say looser as in like American bonsai potters can't make clean or tight pots, because I think that that's not my observation, but they're definitely not as traditional. And so you're going to find newer people in bonsai are going to have just different direction leans, whether it be more traditional or they're going to prefer more of the European American, you know, a little louder pots, or a little bit more. The pots play a little bit bigger role, I think, than in maybe the traditional Japanese culture. And so it really will depend on how the future bonsai practitioners kind of go. But I don't foresee having a shift away from appreciating both. So
years ago, there was one of the Lindsay Farr videos that put out about young Japanese bonsai artists, and the kind of pots and trees they were using were just off the wall. And it looked a lot more like what we're doing here. I don't know that it's necessarily just Japanese, European, American. It's definitely more of the individual artist that's trying to find a pot for their tree. And what are they going to be willing to use?
And yeah. So I guess also the future could hold like more variety, more loud pots. And when we say loud, we're referring to the glaze choices, which if we think about some more traditional Japanese stuff, they are a lot more subdued, or unglazed containers were more popular. So there is a pottery. There's a pottery world that, unless you, I know there's like a lot more studied stuff, like with college type stuff I've seen, where when I was in ceramics for college, I remember seeing a lot of books of professional potters, and the glazing and the forms that you guys are alluding to, that is what bonsai pottery is becoming more and more. I think that's a side. It has this whole appreciation for the form of ceramics over the functionality now at this point. And that's kind of what I'm seeing. I know it sounds very nuanced and kind of almost abstract what I'm saying, but we've all kind of been bouncing back and forth in this. But yeah, I think more like you guys are saying, more loud glazes or more loud pottery, as far as making a statement for the potter and not just showing the display as a whole, as just like everything's balanced, but you don't want to throw it off balance too. I mean, there's so much going on, but yeah, I mean, this conversation has been really good to kind of give our listeners an idea of, you know, when you start bonsai, you can't just think about the trees. I mean, you can be a bonsai practitioner and just deal with bonsai. That's it. Or you guys can choose the path like you guys have chosen and become bonsai potters. And so before we start wrapping this up, let me go ahead and ask each one of you guys y'all's degree of bonsai trees versus bonsai pottery. Because I remember I talked to Byron Myrick about this, and he said he's got trees, but he feels like the pots get way more attention. So do you guys feel like, whoever wants to go first, like as far as y'all's bonsai collections, how do y'all feel that balance feels for bonsai pottery and trees?
I don't have anything I would really consider bonsai right now. I still have some trees in pots, but I've killed hundreds and hundreds of trees, and it's shameful, but I can't balance that right now. So I'm focusing on starting my pottery center and making bonsai pots and making functional pots. And I have some trees in the ground that are okay. They're alive. And that's pretty much it.
I'm back into bonsai. I got sort of distracted from it with some medical things not so long ago, where I lost a lot of my trees that mattered a whole lot to me. And now that I'm feeling much better, I'm back into my trees. I'm finding a balance between burnout in the studio and going outside and working on a tree for a little while and just maintaining and doing the things you need to do for my trees. And I find a balance in that.
Yeah.
So for me, I would say, you know, it's a balance that kind of goes back and forth at times. You know, of course, I started making, became a potter because I wanted to make bonsai pots. I had done a little bit of pottery in my undergrad in college, but it wasn't until I had a functional use that I really kind of moved in that direction. So, you know, the trees have always been and probably will always be, you know, a pretty important part. But I have like kind of a cycle where it's like I try to make a bunch of pots in the winter, and then I have about a month where I can't work on my pottery at all because I got to repot trees and I got to, you know, kind of let the bonsai be the my free time in the spring when I can. And, you know, I kind of have to have windows where, you know, the pottery can be in full force for a little while. And then I'm going to need to take, you know, 3 or 4 days off to do summer maintenance or, you know, different kind of seasonal care. But I think right now my bonsai benches have again grown probably beyond where I should probably be maintaining them. And a little bit of scaling back is likely to be in the next season or two as I'm shifting to maybe some nicer trees, but maybe not having quite so many.
Yeah. Yeah. So for our listeners out there, you can kind of get a feel like about how things work. I mean, I would love to get into doing, you know, and creating bonsai pottery, but I just know that the way that my brain works, if I went in and started making pots, I would spend all of my waking hours just grinding it out and things would get neglected on the other end. So everybody has a different process in which, you know, they function, in which they work with. But I mean, when it comes back to it, I mean, it's all about the trees. That's why we're here. That's what we're talking about this. It's, you know, it's why these three amazing potters have gotten together and decided to create collaborative work. And that's very awesome to know that this type of stuff is happening. And I just want to say I appreciate you guys. I'm sure a lot of our listeners and other bonsai practitioners appreciate you guys doing stuff like this, because it adds more flavor and more lore to the bonsai, American bonsai adventure and world, you know. So that's awesome that you guys are doing this. And so just as we kind of come to a close here, you guys are talking about making all these wonderful pieces. Will some of these pieces be available for purchase? Should people be looking out for them at upcoming bonsai conventions, or are there ways to find them?
Yes, I, for one, will be in Chicago in August. Certainly a couple of pots that are being made here or inspired here will be there. Hopefully some of the collaborative pieces will be there as well. Then we will all be vendors at Kannapolis at the Bonsai Winter Silhouette Expo this upcoming December, which is a great show. If you've not been up there yet, we highly recommend going. It's a wonderful, wonderful time.
Excellent. Yeah. Keep y'all's eyes peeled at those events all bonsai pots made by potters like you guys are one of a kind, but these will be truly special pieces. And I mean, will you guys be signing each of the pots with each signature so people will know, or will people just have to know when they pick the piece up from y'all?
These collaborative pots have three signatures on the bottom.
Cool.
So we're signing all three, and it's kind of fun. At the end, we're like all signing our pots.
Right. Yeah.
Sure. Cool. Excellent. Yep. So keep an eye out. If you're a bonsai pottery collector and you are listening to this episode and you're a fan of one of these guys' works, all of these guys' works, I mean, I think that would be like a holy grail piece right there, in my opinion. That would be really cool. Like I said, that's really awesome that you guys are doing this type of thing. And so I guess starting, because of the way I can see you guys on the camera, I'll start with Rob. So where can they find your pottery for sale? Just a shout out real quick if they wanted to contact you or purchase pottery from you.
Sure, I appreciate it. So I have Wallace Woods Pottery online, and it will take you to link to most of the medium and smaller stuff I sell on Etsy. And so that's linked from my website. That's majority of it. And then I'll do some shows throughout the year.
Yep. And then for Eli, where do they find your stuff?
I post most of my stuff on social media at Instagram and Facebook under Waldo Street Pottery. And there's also waldostreetpottery.com that I restock when I have pots available.
Awesome. Yeah. And then for Preston, where can they find your stuff at?
I'm at preston.albert on Instagram, and I have pots for sale at talbertceramics.com.
Awesome. Yeah. Go over and look up each of these Instagrams, give them a follow, you know, comment on a video, tell them that you heard the show, and, you know, purchase a pot from these guys. Keep an eye out for them at shows. Go shake their hands. All excellent potters. Go out. You know, I had the pleasure of going out onto Bonsai Central's show area and talking bonsai with you guys. I don't believe that Preston was there.
Nope.
No. But yeah, unfortunately. Yeah, in spirit. But yeah, I mean, if you get a chance, it's always a good idea to go out and look at the show floor with the guys who are creating half the work out there and getting their opinions, getting their takes and their thoughts. I mean, this is really valuable information. If you're going from beginner to a little bit more of an advanced bonsai practitioner, getting in the head of a bonsai potter a little bit more to understand the why will give you a much broader appreciation of the how did the bonsai get to that point? Why does the pot look this way? Why are we worried about these certain things with pots versus trees? You know, I had J.M. Stewart woodworking on to talk about bonsai stands. So it's you have to consider all the things that kind of go into not all the options but all of the components is the actual word I was looking for. All the components for display. You know, this is why we do bonsai. You know, we can talk about developing trees and growing certain species and how to treat certain species for diseases and stuff like that. But when we get past that point, we've mastered the development and the maintenance, then we can start thinking more about the bonsai potter and the stand maker and then, of course, the kusumono or anything else that you might use in your display. So this is a great way to do it. If you guys are listening to this episode, familiarize yourself with bonsai pottery. If you have a local bonsai potter in your home state or in your town, I mean, and you're doing bonsai, I mean, you're making a mistake not talking to these people. You know, this is some of the best relationships is between the bonsai practitioner and the potter, because that's another collaboration there just waiting to happen once the pot's created. So I really appreciate you guys hanging out and talking with me. It's awesome to have as many people on the show as we've had. And this is a new one where I have three guests at the same time who are doing something very, very unique within their own trade, which, I mean, that's really cool. So,
Menage pots.
Menage pots. There you go. That's a great way to put it. But yeah, that's awesome, guys. I'm going to go through and I'm going to read off the patron list, and then I'm going to wrap us up, and then we're going to say goodbye to everybody. Y'all ready for the patron list? Yeah. So it's just going to be me reading it off. So it's not like y'all have to participate or anything, but we always say our patrons at the very end of all of our episodes. So if you are a bonsai best bud, here's your time to shine. Starting off our list with Vicky Off, Boyd Snellgrove, Ricky Ruiz, Joshua Bentley, Snappy Chappers, Joel Jenkins, Justin Knight, Backyard Bonsai, Australia, Ben Crehan, Greenwich Gardens, Taylor Peacock, Chase Pertweet, Austin Atkins, Karen Codswell, Luis Torres, AC Castle, Bonsai Marine, JAS Potts, Chris Fossoon, Timothy Arsenal, Randy Bennett, Victrina Ridgeway, Nate Murray, Nancy Hoffman, Joshua Roth Tools, JM Stewart Woodworking, David N., Varies Bonsai, Sean Seaman, Gilbert Jorez, David J. Baccaccini, David Smith, Hist Warrior, Chantel Wynn, Byron Myrick Pottery, Dale, Eddie Fernandez, Joseph Dominguez, Wesley Thompson, Kyle Forward, Angel Niblock, Andrew Willemley, Christina Carforia, and EW808. I learned what an 808 is from Matt, our editor, recently. I'm sorry, I goofed that up. Apparently an 808 is, I can't remember what it is anymore, so I still don't know what an 808 is. But thanks to all of our patrons for supporting our show. All this counts, all this matters. It helps us continue to have special guests like this and talk to these amazing Bonsai people, you know, just, you know, as many people as we can talk to, of course. And of course, all right, we have our specimen buds at the end of the show. I know Bill Butler won't let me live it down if I don't say it, but it's Unruh UN and Bill Butler of Bill's Bayou, the anchor Bonsai best bud. But thank you guys so much for hanging out and taking your time from y'all's amazing pottery getaway weekend to come and, you know, do this recording with me real fast.
Cool. Thank you.
All right. Yeah. And y'all have a great weekend. Y'all make some really cool pieces. I really hope that I can find a piece with three signatures on it. That would be really awesome to add to the collection. So we'll see.
Yep. One day soon.
Yeah. Yep, hopefully. And Eli, I'll be seeing you at the Louisiana Day of Bonsai soon.
Hey, see you there.
Yeah, dude. All right. Y'all have a great one, guys.